The Cubans could not overcome their anti-blackness in regards to discrimination, so it's really difficult to control that if you don't recognize race.
Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And joining us here in Harlem is Terrell Starr, former national political correspondent for Fusion and one of our In the Thick regulars. Hey, Terrell.
How you doing?
All right. And joining us from Miami is Guillermo Garnier. He's professor of sociology at Florida International University. Hey, Guillermo, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
All right. So we're going to start this week with the story of Fidel Castro, 90 years old. Finally passed away. Guillermo, I mean, how do you even sum up Fidel Castro? I mean, such a complicated legacy, but you know, your thoughts on this.
There is no haiku for Fidel. You know, he's a full-length novel, the Tolstoyevsky, you know, War and Peace, the whole thing. It's a long story, but it's always been a very mixed story. You know, I mean, he's greatly praised by some individuals in parts of the world. He's a hero. Here in Miami, they had conga lines going yesterday down 8th Street, celebrating his death, which is a kind of a morbid beginning of a day. But I think Fidel is one of those figures where history is going to not come down on one side or the other. I think you'll have different narratives. You'll have narratives that say when he did good, he did very, very good. And then you'll have narratives that say when he was bad, he was very, very bad. And that's, I think, is going to be his legacy, is the ambivalence of his rule.
So, Terrell, Guillermo's talking about the complex feelings a lot of people have for Castro. And you've written a lot recently about how African-Americans in particular saw Castro. So tell me more about that.
I think particularly with black people, I don't know if you remember a story with Colin Kaepernick. He wore a T-shirt, and that T-shirt had a image of Fidel Castro and Malcolm X on it. And I believe there are a few world leaders on it. And so the reporter from, I think, the Miami Herald had a back and forth with Kaepernick, and Kaepernick was sharp. And he said, well, you know, we have mass incarceration over here and we have disappearances here. And I think that with Kaepernick, he carries the same tone as many black people here around the country and as well as in Africa, right? Because one thing you say about Fidel Castro was that he did send troops over to several African nations to help them in their independence. And before America took a stand against apartheid, Castro did. Now, did he do terrible things to his people? That's also true. But I think with people of color here in the country, particularly black folk, we are always looking for a political ideology that we thought that we could seek black liberation through, even though it was imperfect. And I think that Fidel Castro provided the best example of that in ways that we haven't even seen in our own country.
When I was there in 1995, covering the story of the exodus of the Balseros, and I asked the waiter at the hotel, talk to me about the new man and the new woman that your Cuba is supposed to be creating, right? Because I was kind of embodying that, like, give me the ideology, because all these people were leaving the island. And I was like, but you guys were supposed to be creating this new man and new woman. And he looked at me and he was like, no, girl, that's like gone. We kind of have to, you know, to put that reality too, that Castro did symbolize this. But on the other hand, dude, like, something happened there. The ideology was real, but it wasn't really what ended up happening on the ground.
If you look at Fidel's trajectory, I see one Fidel that has tried to do many, many things, and some of which have not turned out so well. Early on, it was a very interesting project. When I say there's one Fidel, it's because the same people that loved Fidel in 1959 hated Fidel, the same Fidel in 1964. You know, they ended up in Miami. So you have this one guy who's really bigger than Cuba, but that's trying to change everything from race relations to class relations to dependency on the United States. And it's a big plate, and he doesn't pull it all off at once. I mean, look at the immigration pattern. I think what Maria said is absolutely right. You know, you keep Cubans keep coming. Since 1995, you've had 500,000 Cubans come to the United States.
So on the topic of all of these Cubans who are leaving the island, I'm thinking of something particularly interesting that I saw you, Terrell, write on Twitter. And you wrote this: the problem with communism as a political ideology is that it stresses class over race. That logic rarely works, if ever. And I'm just like, as somebody who studied political economy. It was like it was always class and then race. And you're just like, no, 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 not in today's world.
Well, here's the thing, right? The same conversation that we're having about Fidel Castro is a similar dynamic that took place in the former Soviet Union. And so as opposed to dealing with the racism issues with the Afro-Cubans in Cuba, the Soviet Union was actually trying to get rid of racial discrimination in the Soviet Republic states, such as in Kazakhstan. Because one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that there was, during the Tsarist era, there were Jim Crow policies before 1917. So black people were not necessarily Africans, but they were Central Asians. Chorny, which is the Russian word for black, also included them.
What is the Russian word for
Chorny? People who are from Central Asia and the Caucasus. So Georgians, people from Chechnya, Dagestan, that word was all inclusive. And so if you read the book, I Wonder As I Wander by Langston Hughes, you'll see that he talks about going on buses where there are old partition areas during the Tsarist era that were restricted for the black people under the description that I described. And so when the Soviets came in, they did, in fact, get rid of it. The problem is that when you're dealing with human beings, some form of privilege is going to prevail.
Absolutely.
And with the Russians, it was their Slavicness. They could not overcome that. And I think when we think about Cuba, we have to, and I have to ask, you can dovetail into this, Maria. What I found in Cuba, because I haven't been there, but it's based on my studies and people I've spoken to in my work, it was that the Cubans could not overcome their anti-blackness in regards to discrimination. So that was one of the downfalls there. And it's really difficult to control that if you don't recognize race.
Every society has an ideology that tries to present its what should be in its society. Hey, we're all created equal in the United States, right? It says so in the Constitution. Why not? I mean, in the Declaration of Independence. But in the Cuban sense, you have this cultural hybridity between African traditions in religion, African traditions in culture that create what's called, has been called an ajiaco, a Cuban mix where you have European influences in religion and culture with African religion and culture. So you have this Afro-Cuban religion that any white Cuban will take on and own, you know, say, hey, we're Afro-Cuban. I like the Wawanko. I like the, you know, it's like part of us, no matter the color of your skin. At the same time, you have, as Karl Marx said, the situation where if you have a conquered people, are you always going to have a relationship of subservience over those conquered people? And I think that we will go beyond a racist society at some point, but we don't see that because we are very, very in Cuba, you have racism today. It's different than American racism, but you do have a racism that's based on the fact that there was a conquered people. You have a sense of pride in being Afro-Cuban, but you also have a sense of dominance of the white over the black. So I think you have a mixture in Cuba that it's different than the United States, but you do have racism.
Hey, it's Julio. It's been an interesting year with a lot of emotions, but we are doing our work producing independent media for you. We are dependent on you right now because In the Thick is produced by the nonprofit media organization, the Futuro Media Group. It's a difficult time for us. Now more than ever, independent journalism and the Futuro matters. If you believe in what we bring to the national conversation, go to inthethick.org and click on the donate button and consider supporting us with a monthly gift. Every penny helps our independent media. Oh, and one more favor. After you donate, please share why the Futuro matters to you on social media using the hashtag #TheFuturoMatters. We'll share your message, and you may even hear it on air. Here's one tweet from a recent donor, Juan Escalante. My parents worked hard to bring us to the U.S. The Futuro is the only way we can honor their sacrifices. Hashtag #TheFuturoMatters. Please join Juan by going to inthethick.org and clicking on the donate button. Thank you.
Welcome back to In the Thick. With me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. Also, Terrell Starr, an independent journalist, and Guillermo Grenier. He's professor of sociology at Florida International University. Let's get back to the conversation now. Let's think about Castro within Latin America. Because for me, you know, I'm so, to be honest with you, so overwhelmed with what's happening with our domestic politics and the uncertainty of domestic politics here. I actually tweeted this out. Cuba and the United States, two countries with absolutely uncertain political futures. Right? I'm just like, oh my God, we're comparing. But setting
it's
that aside,
terrifying.
Right? I mean, it's just crazy. But in terms of Latin America, I mean, Fidel Castro has a huge impact in terms of what he means to that region. I think he will forever be seen as a product of what happens when you have colonialism, is that you will produce someone like a Fidel Castro. What's your take on that, Terrell?
Okay, let's start off with the fact that as a reporter who covered this campaign, I am very concerned about the fact that we spent little time with the candidates talking about Latin American politics.
There you go.
Okay, so let's think about this. Let's think about this, y'all. We had three debates. We had the Republican primaries and the Democratic primaries. How much time was devoted to Latin America? Mm-hmm. I don't remember much.
But wait, Terrell, did you miss the fact that every single moderator in all of the presidential debates was a Latino immigrant? What's the matter with you?
I think I did.
That's right.
But going back to your question specifically and addressing it, one, we have to remember Cuba was a staging ground for the Soviet Union. We also have to remember that there's a historical memory with Cuba that even before Fidel Castro, America was very hostile to Cuba. And people tend to...
Although they did party there a lot.
And they did party there a lot. And then again, if you go back to Langston Hughes' book, even after...
I am going to buy that book right now.
What you need to do... I mean, no, this is, because this context is very important. You know, the point is that when Langston Hughes went over, he even talked about the color line that was established after the once the Americans gave away its protectorate status. Listen, that's white supremacist language for an occupation. That's all it is. Okay, but anyway, when you think about what this means for the rest of Latin America, I think that there is a policy vacuum. And I'm particularly concerned about Donald Trump's rhetoric in regards to human rights and him saying that, you know, Obama's deal was a bad deal. Listen, we have not benefited at all from isolating Cuba. What monetary, political, or moral gain have we achieved by isolating them? Zero.
And the thing is, Terrell, I guess the question that I have, being a student of Latin American history and actually covering Cuban and Puerto Rican history, I've always been fascinated, Guillermo, as to why Castro has been so admired by many Latin Americans. Is it just an affinity of political ideology, or is there something deeper here?
No, look at the time when Fidel was had his mojo going in the 60s. That's a revolutionary period in every continent. You had 1968. Well, I mean, 1968 was a big year in just about every continent, from Mexico to Europe. Fidel was symbolic, not only symbolic, but he's inspirational. Let's face it, people don't want to very often face the fact that Fidel was an iconic figure in Latin American history. Very few people like Fidel have been able to mobilize an entire country's, an entire continent like Fidel has. Now, in Cuba's role as standing up to the United States, and that's what his influence in Latin America has been, I think that part of the Obama initiative has been, in fact, to kind of rebuild that bridge of how well the United States can relate to Latin America. And I mean, nobody can ever accuse Donald Trump of being a policy wonk, but he's got somebody's got to be talking to him about the importance of Cuba beyond the 305 area code down here.
He's what we have, and we have to talk about him because he's what we have.
Oh,
so unfortunately,
goodness.
So
Cuba is critical for Latin America, for the U.S. relationships with Latin America, and Cuba is critical for a recognition that U.S. foreign policy can influence other countries' behaviors. I mean, right now, like Terrell said, you know, we've isolated Cuba for 50-some years. What have we gained? I think every failed policy should get a review every 50 years or so. And we haven't gotten anything.
We've seen a contrast already in statements by both President Obama and Donald Trump. Trump basically went out there, after he tweeted out, you know, Fidel Castro is dead, you know, exclamation point. He condemned Castro as a brutal dictator. And then Obama, on the other hand, was much more measured. Will Trump's hard line, lead to democracy in Cuba? I mean, it seems like a disconnect, no? Or am I wrong?
Cuba right now, before Fidel died, I mean, this is kind of paradoxical, but before Fidel died, Donald Trump probably had no incentive or no reason to continue an Obama legacy. I mean, Cuba clearly is an Obama legacy on this. But now Fidel's dead. This is like, borrón y cuenta nueva. You know, like this is...
How do you say that in English? Let's see.
Let bygones be bygones, or a new page.
Or wiping the slate clean.
Wiping the slate clean.
Turning a new leaf.
New leaf. All of the above, right? So here we are. This is...
I need to learn Spanish since I'm going to be on your show all the time.
The whole country needs to learn Spanish.
Oh, we hold... But no, especially me. I don't like being left out of these little cool one-on-ones. No.
Never left out.
Translated to like five different ways. So I think you got more of a gist of it than we ended up. But anyway, so what you have now is that an opportunity for Trump to say, all right, that was then, but this is now. And we're going to try to get a new deal, you know, a better deal. He uses, you know, his jargon or whatever. But I think that this does offer an opportunity because obviously the Cubans have been waiting, Cuban Americans, the voting bloc that everybody thinks is monolithic. And even though, by the way, Clinton did better than Obama by 11 or 12 points in Cuba precincts, I analyzed this. But the Cuban population has been waiting for Fidel to die. Well, hey, Fidel's dead. Now what? Are you going to hang on for Raul to die or retire? Then, okay, what are you expecting then to happen? I think that at some point, the U.S. foreign policy has to kind of discard this Cuban American myth that, you know, we have all this power down here in Miami. I think you've got to act on foreign policy decisions based on U.S. foreign policy interests. And Latin America is clearly part of looking at what to do about Cuba.
What Donald Trump, Mike Pence, and many of the people who are nominated to be a part of Donald Trump's team, they've all focused on human rights. Right. We all know that human rights has never been a precursor for us to deal with any country.
And actually, let me kind of add a little bit of something. It's interesting because, you know, a lot of the U.S. media outlets basically are falling into line in a critical take on Castro, the dictator, the hardliner, but essentially operating on the assumption that the United States was like all fabulous and wonderful during this entire period.
Yeah.
I don't know. Let's just think back about Nixon's war on drugs. I mean, all of that. But anyway, I want to quote what Fidel Castro had to say in 1978 at the World Communist Youth Conference. And this is what he said. Con qué moralidad? I know I should be getting my Fidel.
Did you just do like Fidel Castro? Wow.
I'm pretending I have a beard, but let me just continue reading this in my voice. Okay. So with what morality can U.S. leaders talk about human rights in a country where there are millionaires and beggars, where blacks face discrimination, where women are prostituted and great masses of Chicanos, Puerto Ricans and Latin Americans are deprecated, exploited and humiliated? So basically, I'm wondering this. I mean, regardless of whether Castro was good or bad, can the United States really claim a moral high ground here?
I think that you have a dynamic where the U.S., I mean, we throw the first stones, we cast the first stones, right? But we really have very little moral standing given our own injustices and I think our own imbalances in our society of power, et cetera. But I think that Fidel's death does matter. I mean, not only to Fidel, but my question is, and I'm not sure the Cuban exile community, the ones that go on about human rights as being in essential to improving relations, et cetera, I don't know to what degree they have a plan for after Fidel has died. I mean, they've been waiting for Fidel to die forever, and now he's dead. And now what? We've given Fidel superhuman powers that now since he's gone, there's a hope that Cuba will crumble. It's not going to happen. Cuba's a full society. It's got institutions. It's got, you know, they try to mess with tax structures just like we do. They do all kinds of other things besides oppress people. You know, they have an entire society there, and it's not going to crumble. Now, I'm not sure that there's a plan for after Fidel. You know, I mean, people were talking about immigration coming. Once upon a time, I was on this committee where we were looking at, well, what will happen to Florida after Fidel dies? And the number one concern was that Cubans will start just packing up from Cuba and start coming to the United States. Well, obviously, they'd started doing that before Fidel died. So what now is the question, I think, that I would ask the Cuban-American community here that's been waiting so long for this moment.
There's something else that's going to happen with the death of Fidel Castro, which is the whole conversation about Cuban immigration and the wet foot, dry foot policy, which, as you know, Guillermo, down there in Miami, I mean, it's real, right? I mean, there are undocumented immigrants from, let's say, places like Venezuela or Colombia or Mexico or Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, who are saying, wait, we're fleeing violence. Our lives are under threat, and yet we can't get a hearing. But if you're Cuban and you put your foot on land, you're good.
That's right. That's right. And that's even a downgrade from what it used to be before Clinton put in the wet foot, dry foot in 1995 immigration agreements. It used to be just we find you in the middle of the ocean and you're Cuban, you're good. The Cuban immigration started coming to the United States during a perfect storm of ideological conflict and geopolitics. You had the Cold War going on. You had the civil rights movement going on. You had all these things that made the Cubans, the white Cubans, first waves of them being mostly white, really well received in the United States. So you have this relationship between the exile community here and the U.S. state with a big S that really has made integration of Cuban Americans into the U.S. Social structures almost painless. I'm not saying it's painless because we all talk about suffering and all that, but it's institutionally, you know, you're here the year and a day and you can file for residency if you're Cuban.
On the ground, Guillermo, in a place like Miami, southern Florida, are there tensions from other immigrants towards Cubans? What does it look like?
I.e. the Haitians.
Yeah, right. The Haitian.
Haitians and Cubans.
Right. So what does it look like, though, Guillermo? Because we're recording in New York, you know. So just paint a picture, if you can, about what that actually feels and looks like on the street.
Well, what it feels like and looks like on the street, and again, it's just like part of nature here now, where you have to recognize that Cubans get a better deal. And now Cubans, but they get a better deal across the board. And so you have the African-American community feels isolated because the Cubans came in and took a lot of the benefits that, say, in Atlanta, the African-American communities were getting the Small Business Administration loans. Here, the Cubans got them. The Haitians started coming in about the same time as Mariel. Right after Mariel, you got 125,000
in the early
Cubans.
80s, right?
You know, and then Haitians start coming, and all of a sudden they're infected with AIDS, and we leave them, and we actually do not deal with them. So you have what you have here, and what you have in South Florida is this recognition that Cubans get a very good deal. Other immigrant groups resent the Cubans. I mean, through ethnographies, from my research, I find that all the time. Cubans are taking over. They get the special deal. But then on the other hand, they are the ones that have been here for the longest period of time, and you've got to create alliances with them if you want to move up in the world. You know, they're kind of like the Brahmins of Boston. Miami was incorporated into a city in 1896, and Cubans have been here half that time since Miami's been a city.
Literally. The whiteness.
Yeah, and they're white. So you have this kind of ambivalent feeling, and I keep saying that word just because the Cubans are here. They're part of the power structure. You've got to create alliances with them. But at the same time, you resent them along class lines, racial lines, and benefits that they get from the U.S. government.
Terrell, jump in.
I was on Twitter all yesterday talking about this whole dynamic.
And I was not.
Twitter all day?
And I wrote a whole thread about black communism and the relationship between black people and white Cubans, and a wide range of people jumped in. And so a lot of people criticized me for being insensitive to the Cuban exile. Here's the bottom line. Cuban exiles were coming to this country in 1959. You know what the law of the land was? Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. The law of the land was you had places in many southern states where black folk could not even vote. He had poll tax. He had a wide range of things. And so when you deal with these people who've been dealing with oppression for hundreds of years, they're not going to have enough room to deal with your pain, particularly if they feel that you're taking advantage of whiteness and you have the ability to integrate and become white, regardless of whether you're from Cuba or from Ireland or from Poland or from any place else. If you have the ability and you have the social status and structure to integrate into white society, you're not going to get a lot of sympathy from a Haitian who was dealing with Papa Doc or dealing with his son, yet they struggle to get a green card.
it's time to move to our final segment, which is called Mic Drop.
Mic Drop!
So this is a segment where guests get to choose from a list of options for their final words. You say your piece, and then you drop the mic.
Okay, so here are the five options that you guys can choose from. Fantasy CNN, What's Missing, Tough Questions, a new one, Mea Culpa, which is a mistake that you made in your thinking recently, and Side Eye, someone or something that really messed up recently and needs to be called out and given that side eye. And for our listeners, which are exploding in numbers, if you have any ideas that you want us to add to this list, just tweet them at us. But for now, I don't know. Let's start with you, Guillermo. What do you choose?
I have a mea culpa. I've been doing these polls, these Cuban polls. They're most cited Cuban-American polls everywhere for the last 20 years. And I keep seeing these changes in the Cuban-American population that we just mentioned. But at the same time, they keep the same people keep getting elected. You have the Ileana Ross-Letnans. You have Curbelo. You have Díaz Balart. You have all these same guys that have been there 20-some years in Ileana's case. So I have to look deeply at what it matters when you do polls. So what if the opinions are changing? So what if the U.S.-Cuban relations are being seen differently than between the early arrivals and the most recent arrivals? I think ultimately I got to recognize that Cubans, I always talk about them not being Cuban-Americans, not being monolithic. Well, they're definitely not monolithic. And not only that, but they vote on other things besides Cuba. They vote on crime. They vote on education. They vote on Social Security and Obamacare, et cetera. And I've got to incorporate that into a bit of my analysis besides hopefully being optimistic all the time that the population is finally going to take a turn and recognize that engagement is the best way to change Cuba.
Terrell, what do you choose?
I have a side eye.
And he's giving it to me right now.
Marco Rubio this weekend mentioned on Twitter that Fidel Castro was abusive to gay people. Oh, really? I find it interesting because Mr. Rubio, if I remember correctly, I don't think that he's a bastion of LGBTQ rights himself. Am I wrong? Did I miss something going on here? You know, I know that there are a number of some bathroom bills that are going on in North Carolina and a few other states. Has he said anything about that? No. I think that he was trying to be politically expedient, and I found it to be very sick. I remember him very specifically saying that, you know, if we keep on advancing the rights of these gay folk, this is going to go against religious liberties and freedom. Really, as if some person who's LGBTQ cares about where you pray. I don't think they care. So, yes, he gets a wicked side eye for being full of it.
And a bit of a mic drop right there from Terrell. Julio?
I'm choosing What's Missing. It's actually a story that's happening out of Puerto Rico in the last week. What's happening in the southern municipality of Peñuelas, which is near the city of Ponce, is that a small group of environmental protesters are out literally trying to blockade, to stop the transport of toxic coal ash being dumped in open landfills. The company AES did it out in the Dominican Republic previously, and there was a lot of investigative reporting that the coal ash led to birth defects and sickness and illness. And what's really interesting is that it's a small group of protesters that's growing every day. Their political leaders speaking out, more than 60 arrests, people trying to blockade Puerto Rican police and live stream. And it just has this feeling of a Puerto Rican. And I know this is going to sound really weird, but it just has this feeling that it might be growing and who knows. So, Maria, what do you got?
I'm going to start with a side eye, which I'll also call mal de ojo, to President-elect Donald Trump for his, undertone of alleging that undocumented immigrants would actually go out and vote. As I just tweeted out, that's basically like an undocumented immigrant walking up to a detention center or an immigration officer and saying, "Hi, deport me." It's completely unrealistic and doesn't happen. So that's my side eye. But the truth is I have a mea culpa. Because I hosted Thanksgiving for the first time in my adult life. And so, you guys, I totally disconnected from media. I was not watching. And I feel really bad about that, especially because...
How is that a mea culpa? That seems to be like I'm very jealous.
Yeah, but then you feel bad. You know, you start seeing things. And in particular, what's happening in Standing Rock. I'm so concerned with what's happening with the protesters there and the coverage. I mean, it looks like a young lady may have lost her arm. It's a really dangerous situation out there, but I feel bad because I did take a couple of days to just disconnect, but it was great for my family.
I think that's most important at the end of the day.
Right, at the end of the day.
Thank you for the tortillas again.
Oh, right. And then I did deliver tortillas all last week. Terrell, I owe you a pack of tortillas.
Uno, dos, tres.
My thanks to Terrell Starr, who's an independent journalist, and to Guillermo Grenier, who's a professor of sociology at Florida International University. Thanks for joining Julio and me on In the Thick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And remember to go to iTunes to rate and review us, which really helps. Also, follow us on Twitter, please, at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook. We're also on Instagram at In the Thick Show. And tell your friends and all of your neighbors and take us to your next dinner party. Our producer is Noam Hassenfeld. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. Some of our music is composed by Noam. And the other music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Records. We'll see you again next time on In the Thick. Thanks for listening. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.